Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, how do you report on a general election? Journalists from across the press have come together to ask that question in this brave new world of AI, deepfakes and partial broadcasting. Also on the programme, why is the cost of optioning books rising so fast? And we take a look at the finances of News UK. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, the BBC are to outsource much of their Indian newsroom in order to comply with strict new government rules on foreign media investment. This follows a raid of the BBC's bureaus by tax inspectors in 2023. The result is a highly unusual setup for the BBC, which has faced mounting pressure from the Indian authorities about its critical reporting. Jordan North has started his show on Capital, reuniting with fellow Radio 1 alumnus Chris Stark, who moved to Global a few years ago. With an overwhelmingly positive response from the press this week, are we starting to see a new breakfast war? And the Italians are up in arms after a TV ad premiered this week that was considered blasphemy by Catholic viewers. The ad showed nuns receiving their favourite brand of crisps as communion. Yes, it's been a slow media week. But let's head over to Westminster now and see who's joining us to talk about some of the other stories in the media this week. So kicking off today's special organised by the Media Society, it's journalist and an AI expert who's most recently been executive editor at Newsweek, Alex Hudson. Hello.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm very good. And also with us is investigative reporter James Ball. James, where are we? What are we doing?
So we are at the very lovely offices of Prospect magazine, where we are going to be talking about how you actually cover a general election, whether you're the BBC and you've got all of the exit poll and all of reporters around the country at the stations, whether you're the lobby, and we've also got polling supremo Rob Ford. So we're going to be trying to work out how does the mechanics of all of this get done.
And we'll try and catch up with some of those people later on. Alex, what makes this general election so special?
A million different things, I think. So the thing that I didn't realise is that only one of the party leaders has faced a general election before. So obviously Sunak hasn't, Starmer hasn't, the list goes on and on and on. So actually we are in the age of no one quite knows what's going to happen. I think we're in the age where no one believes the media anymore, which has been getting worse for a while, but now we're bottomed out into that. And we're in the age where no one is, well, fewer people than ever are reading the national media, and more people are relying on social media to get their news, even though Instagram and Facebook have turned off politics from their feeds by default.
I was listening to a podcast this week that had an opener to explain to people how to turn politics back on Instagram so that their posts would reach them, reach their audience again. It's gone a bit mad.
Is that mad or is that just a good business model? Advertising is less lucrative around political content, around difficult content, around war content. If those social media companies want to grab attention and keep attention and get money from advertisers, turn politics off does make sense, you know, at the extent of democracy, at the harm of democracy, but, you know, good business.
So news has been in the news this week, particularly with Scoop, the new Netflix series. Alex, I think we've forced you to watch Scoop. Did you have a lovely time doing that?
You asked me nicely and I said yes, and I would never have watched it if you hadn't asked so nicely, and it was fine. It was history being written in the present tense. It is Gillian Anderson being Gillian Anderson. It is a perfectly polite, perfectly fine bit of TV, but why is it being made? Why does it exist? What is the point of it? Who is it for? Except for Netflix's desire to reach American audiences with stuff about the royal family and around sexual crimes and alleged sexual crimes. And that's all it's good for.
So I have the unusual privilege of I have been a character in a dramatisation of a sort of story that I've done. And even I can't say that that film was good. I think there's about one good journalistic film, maybe two, and sadly none of the ones that I was in. And from what I hear, Scoop probably isn't the one either.
Well, if you don't want to watch it, there's another one along shortly, which is the Amazon Emily Maitlis one. Okay, this week, News Group Newspapers, owners of The Sun, Times and Talk TV released their last year's accounts. The Sun have halved their losses and revenues are down, but those phone hacking claims, they're not going away, though the costs are reducing. Time seems to be faring okay. Revenue is down, but profits are up. What's the opportunity, do you think, for the Times?
The opportunity for the Times is that they are doing the quality. So they are doing the quality over the quantity. So News UK has the advantage of having both Sun and the Times. So when it comes with the quality, you have that subscription business, which is probably going to be the only business in town. And you've got the Sun, which hits half of British adults, which is a mind-blowing number. And in that regard, they are winning against the Daily Mail and most of Reach, even though the Reach CEO, Jim Mullen, said, we need page views because that's how we sell ads. But for the Times is doing good work and it is more focused on Big J journalism than some of its competitors. And so that's where its market is. It has an appointment with audiences. It's keeping its appointment with audiences. And it seems like those financials are getting better slowly.
James, the output's good, doing quite well. Numbers, as Alex was saying, we're getting slightly better. It's still a pretty dismal way to run a business, though, isn't it?
So, in what sense? I think there's quite a lot of positive for News UK. I mean, they've got a lot of problems in the broadcast area. They sort of had this abortive talk TV. All of their market research said it wouldn't work. All of their senior executives thought it wouldn't work. Rupert Murdoch told them to do it anyway, and they've had to do it. So they've had to manage the core business with a huge amount of distraction and turmoil. And so these are quite good numbers given that. I think the Times is now looking like a sustainable, profitable business on its own. And 10 years ago, you would not have believed that. You know, the Sun, it's partly about can it ever dig itself out of dealing with all of this historical phone hacking stuff? Of course, the Sun's never admitted any liability for phone hacking, but they have paid huge amounts in settlements. Listeners will draw their own conclusions. But this is a long time since that scandal, and it's still costing them tens of millions every year and huge amounts of attention. And it's very hard for them to be fixing their business models and to be looking to the future while they're still so embedded in the past.
Talk TV, they had a loss before tax of £53.7 million. They're coming off the EPG, but are going to exist online. Alex, do you think it's a very expensive way to get some decent studios and to rethink what your YouTube strategy is?
I mean, that just sounds like your opinion, doesn't it? I mean, of course it does. Like, if you're trying to do linear TV, why? If you're trying to do stuff still for broadcast as a first port of call, why? If you're still recording in landscape as a first port of call, despite what TikTok's recent algorithm changes will have you believe, why? Think portrait, think digital, think as a top of funnel way to build people into your brand rather than it just being a standalone product. As you were saying, like, it Talk TV didn't make any sense from the start. How they pivot and how they think about what they do next, I don't know what the answer is to that at all.
James, think they can do it?
I think there's clearly a viable video strategy to be found. It probably doesn't come from adapting linear TV. I suspect that other than doing a sort of few words and keeping it the name, they'll probably throw out all of the linear strategy, disconnect it from talk radio entirely, and try something completely different. But video, if you're under 25, it's the primary form of communication. Audio is then second, text is nowhere. If you want an audience as that group sort of comes into their main news consumption era, if you want an audience of adult professionals in 10 years, in 15 years, you need a video strategy. So I think someone will find one. And then everyone else will copy them, and then you'll have to innovate format again and again and again. That's how the influencers do it, and that's probably how we're going to have to learn how to do it.
And we'll let James nip away to get ready for the event. And lastly, a report in Broadcast suggests that the cost to TV companies to option books has skyrocketed in the past year. Do we know why this is, Alex?
Because there's no money, because there is a sort of grand adjustment in the streaming companies. So everyone's gone. The markets are finally sorting themselves out. So Netflix is kind of stable. Amazon Prime is stabilizing. Disney Plus is, and those are the big players. And so everyone wants some dead certs. And so if you've sold 4 million books, then chances are you'll have 4 million people at least who are willing to watch this. So if you take the, what is that problem called? The three body problem. That sold how many millions of books? 6-7 million? Lots of millions of books before it was made. That is a fantastic piece of television. And because there's two more books to go, there's two more series in that, which means they have a steady form of income. And that will bring in people who aren't traditionally Netflix consumers into that product. And so when you're looking for the next hit, you're looking for normal people, you're looking for all of these big hits. What's the book I haven't read? Change l'heure de fleur, Freshwater for Flowers, that apparently is now a bidding war that's happening. So I might have to go back and read it, but that's sold 4 million copies already, and that's why there's a bidding war, because if you have 4 million people who already know about the brand before you even have to start, it saves you from having to do another Marvel movie. It's how do you create new IP without having to start from scratch.
And also what we see with all the streamers is they've sort of left prestige behind them and have sort of gone for high-end mainstream. We've talked about it on the show before. These are like kitchen island dramas, things that kind of look nice, things that seem kind of quite high-end, as if it's like an ITV drama with some cash spent on it. I think this kind of fits into that, doesn't it, with people going for bankers.
If you think about the sorts of people who are most likely to be core consumers, it will be the sort of the core family unit, which is where Disney Plus stands to gain. It is the middle class, middle England, or you know, pick a country, the global appeal. So it has to be timeless, relatively speaking. It has to be broad appeal, and it has to have something unique to it. And so I don't know what the answer is to that one. But I think they still have more money to spend than any of the traditional broadcasters. And so that's why they're getting all of the pick of the bunch. But they have slightly less money to spend than back when Netflix was in a growth phase.
Okay, thanks, Alex. We're going to nip off and see this session and talk to some of the participants.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day the world first heard about nudge theory.
Then on Tuesday, we revisit the non-fairy tale wedding of Charles and Camilla.
On Wednesday, the day the banana first came to Britain.
On Thursday, pack your bags. We're off to Butland's first holiday camp.
And on Friday, the day Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I'm with Katie Searle. You had quite a fun job for a long time, looking after the BBC's political coverage. You said on the panel today that at 6:01 every morning you'd often get a call from one of the political parties. Is that something you ever get used to?
Actually, amazingly, you do get used to it. As I said on the panel, I think it's getting used to the fact that actually they are doing their job. And I do genuinely think that actually they are under a lot of pressure to deliver. And if they're not trying to persuade me to change our coverage one way or the other, then they probably should be. And so actually, if you take it in that spirit, as opposed to you're shouting at me and it's a personal attack, it's much more easy to deal with. Because like, take a breath, you know, I'll ring you back, you know, I've only just woken up, or you know, give me 10 minutes to look at what you're even shouting about, because I haven't even seen it, which happened quite a lot, and then take a really kind of measured view about what you're going to do about it.
So you get to look on this year, which must be actually quite fun too. Every election is different, different group of people often, different range of parties. What's the big challenge for broadcasters covering the election this year?
Really good question. Look, I'm going to say the missed disinformation and AI, mostly actually because I think it's the new challenge. I don't think that in the end it will make a huge difference in terms of people's voting. I do think it will have an influence on some news cycles, and that could be 2-3 days, which is a, you know, a decent chunk out of 6 weeks if there's a few of those over that. So I think, you know, that will be the difference, in that we've gone from social media and Twitter storms, which really influenced particularly in 19, to this time I think the kind of actual AI fake news, the video, the stills purporting to be politicians when they're not, I think is going to be the main difference and the challenge there.
And we've got a new news and current affairs broadcaster in GB News. They'll obviously be quite a few people on the right, Tory and other parties, who might quite like to appear there more often, and probably they'll have a good person on election night as well, I guess.
Yeah, well, Boris Johnson, I think, is committed to being one of their main voices, and a clever ruse by GB News, because of course election rules means that a lot of their main presenters as sitting MPs will have to come off their roster. So in comes the big guns of Boris Johnson. I think we'll have a big effect on how the rest of the campaign is managed as well, because as we know, he makes easy headlines, and easy headlines then tend to get picked up by everybody. So I think.
And do you think they'll take? Do you think the other broadcasters will have to cover him on the night? So he says something at 10:30. Does everyone else have to pick up on it at 11?
Yeah, I think they will. I think they will. I mean, look, he's a, you know, former prime minister. He's a very big figure in this country still. Who knows? He may not be out of politics for that long anyway. And I think, of course, he. You know, people are interested in his views. I think a challenge, again, if I was still at the BBC, was to say, let's not do everything he says, you know, and we don't have to react to everything he says. There will be times where he says something that is newsworthy. There'll be a lot of times when he says stuff that isn't newsworthy, and I think that will be absolutely something that the broadcasters need to look out for.
So previously you've had to talk to political parties about debates, also about big interviews. Do you think we'll see a head-to-head debate by the two political Labour and Conservative leaders this time round?
I absolutely do. 100% there will be head-to-heads. I think the question is how many, not if. So do they do, you know, they'll do ITV, they'll do the BBC, do they do the other broadcasts, do they do GB News, do they do Talk TV, do they do all the other streaming channels that will be all after them to do stuff? So that will be the real question this year.
Katie, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm with Sam Woodhouse, who's the BBC's election editor. We've just been hearing a lot about your planning. How long have you been working on this one?
We've been working on it for probably about 6 months already. You know, and we have some contingency plans just in case, you know, a politician decided to call an election a year early. So, and there's a lot of logistics. So there's an awful lot of contacting local councils in order to arrange the, you know, many dozens of local of election night counts that we have to go to. There's a lot of work there. There's a lot of work in organising the exit polls since there have been boundary changes. There's a lot of graphics to work through and make sure that they're right when you sort of provide graphics with a big flow of live data. Do they work properly? So there's an awful lot of back end, unglamorous planning that takes place. And then on election night, it all kind of hurtles past you at 1,000 miles an hour.
So some previous elections, which happened sooner than you maybe have expected, meant you had to reuse some previous planning. Have you got lots of new tricks, new graphics, new things planned for this one as you've had a bit of time to get ready for them?
We are going to, you know, reinvent things a bit. I mean, the elections that suddenly surprised us in 2017, 2019, we did reuse the kind of graphics kit of parts that we had from previous elections. But, you know, there wasn't everything. Those elections, we only had 6 weeks. And obviously, one thing that always changes between election and election are the outside broadcasts, because you've got totally different shadow cabinet, totally different cabinet. The marginal seats have changed. So those all have to be completely reworked and recontacted. And it takes a lot of time to get around the country for 60 or 70 outside broadcasts. So, I mean, there's an awful lot to do in those very awful snap elections. Involved an awful lot of, you know, working till late.
And I suppose quite a difference on technology-wise. So previously, lots of satellite trucks everywhere, whereas maybe a little easier now to use bonded 4G cards and all of those sorts of things. Does that mean you can be in more places, or it can be more flexible than you have been previously?
I don't think it means you can be in more places. I think that's because the trouble is, I mean, at certain, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning on election night, there are five constituencies declaring every minute. So you just could not get more on. That's the thing, unless they spread out more. And counted over a longer period. So it's not that. And also, we still have some issues with the technology. You know, they're always counted in leisure centres. Leisure centres are giant Faraday cages. It's really very, very difficult to get a signal out just from however many Gs you've bonded or whatever it is. So there still are quite a lot of satellite trucks in there. But it does, you know, it will no doubt be the future at some point. Definitely.
And you're very fortunate in that you get a little sneak peek of the exit poll. What does that feel like? And how many of you know what that exit poll is going to be half an hour before the rest of the country does?
It's quite a small, you keep it as small as possible, because, you know, if it leaked, we're all in deep trouble. I mean, it's illegal, you know. So there's on our programme, there's probably, you know, four or five. You do tell the political editor, because they've got to sum it all up. You do tell the presenter, because they've got to put out the right numbers. And, you know, the producer who presses the button to send it live, they know as well, because they need to preview it and say, yeah, those are the numbers that are going out live. Not much more than that, though.
When you think about what makes a good election night, is it purely the story? Is it the planning? Is it the guests you've got? What's the magic mixture that makes a very, very long programme watchable and interesting for the audience?
I think it's a combination of all of it. I know that's a bit of a sort of weak answer, but it is a combination of all of it. It's the kind of feeling that I always think of it, it's like almost like the original Eviction Show. I was talking about, a few weeks ago, my kids were watching Love Island, you know, me and my partner were watching Traitors. And I was just thinking, well, actually, you know, election night. Just think about, you know, 30 million people go out and vote on election day. When else in a year do 30 million people in this country do the same thing on the same day? And then I kind of like to think of us is that, you know, we're, you know, they then all go home and they turn on at 10 o'clock and they see what they've done. And, you know, the technology you were talking about earlier about the way we cover the election has changed enormously over the last 50 years since the BBC began doing elections. The way they actually administer elections in out there in all the counts has not changed at all. It is still your stubby pencil that you mark your X in a booth in a church hall somewhere. And then they all take them to a leisure centre, and they it is leisure centres now rather than town halls, which used to be. But that's about the only change. And they troop on stage and they make an announcement, you know. So it's very dramatic. And I think that all the kind of graphics create a big sense of event. All that kind of Jeremy Vine sort of magic graphic stuff. And, you know, you see it unfold in front of you over sort of 8 hours. And, you know, political careers are made and wrecked in a really short time. You know, you think you've thought through every scenario, but there have been several elections I've done where it's not the one you thought it was going to be by any... And it's, you know, you see it unfold in front of you. And it's, you know, it's thrilling, really.
And when do you think your programme is going to be on the air this year?
I try and ban that question in every meeting I go to. I'll tell you why. It's the only thing. You go to meetings, and we go to dozens of meetings about elections. It's the only thing anyone wants to talk about. And the trouble is that if you allow people to talk about when you think it's going to be, you never get anything else discussed. So I try and stop it. Just say, well, if it happens now, we ought to be in a position that we can actually do it about it. So, you know, we need to kind of focus on, if it happens now, what graphics have we got? If it happens now, you know, where can we get enough satellite trucks to cover all the counts we're going to go to? So it's the question I try and ban.
Lovely. Sam, thank you very much.
Donato.
Rob Ford from University of Manchester. You get very involved in election campaigns, covering them, particularly for the BBC. What are you looking out for this year when you are taking your polling data and trying to inform the journalists what to do?
Well, I mean, this election is a bit unusual because at present it really looks like it's a case of how big is the win going to be rather than who's going to win. So I think I'll be watching the polling data to see whether or not we're seeing any kind of narrowing in Labour's large lead. And also we've seen a lot of the MRPs, multiple regression and post-stratification. These are sort of, you know, estimates of every single seat. And, you know, they are varying quite a lot. So I'm going to be watching them quite closely because, you know, whether we have a modest Labour majority or a big Labour majority on the same polling could depend on how those votes spread out. So that's going to be another thing I'm going to watch closely.
You mentioned earlier that there's often a gap between the polling data and people's perception of the polling or what they think can happen. And that seems to be quite wide at the moment.
I think that's true. I think if you look at the polling right now, what it's pointing to is possibly the biggest swing from a government to an opposition since polling began, possibly the biggest swing from a government to opposition since the mass franchise began. And people just struggle to imagine that such a big change could happen all in one go. And so they look for reasons why the polling may be wrong. And of course, the polling may be wrong. It may be wrong in itself. It could change between now and election day. But it feels like one of those weird moments where if it does end up being a really massive swing, we'll all look back at where we are right now and say, well, it was really obvious all along, wasn't it? But right now, we're not saying that. We're not saying we're really confident this is going to be some sort of a huge swing and a great big Labour majority, because it just feels like such an unusual event to happen.
And what effect will the smaller parties have on that majority? I mean, the Tories are facing battles from both sides.
That's true. And how the small parties matter is geography as well as polling. So for the Liberal Democrats, what matters is tactical voting. You won't see that in the polling, but they could get 15 seats, they could get 45 seats. Most of those seats will come off the Tory column, so that's really important for the Tory result. The SNP, how they do against Labour in Scotland, that's not really very visible in national polling, but in Scotland-specific polling, they're more or less tied with Labour now. And the thing about the SNP's vote is it's really spread out. So they could win all the seats or lose all the seats on a very small shift in the polls. They could, if they drop another 2 or 3 points, they could lose 30 seats. That's very good for Keir Starmer, totally out of his control to some extent. And then you've got Reform UK, who aren't going to win any seats. Let's get real. Sorry, Richard Tice, you're not going to win any seats. But they have the potential to split the Leave vote in particular that was so important to the Conservatives' 2019 victory, and that could take another 30, 40, 50 seats off the Tory column, and it'll be because they're losing votes that are completely out of the reach of Labour or the Liberal Democrats, but are also right now really hacked off with the government.
And so when is the election going to be, and what have you pinned down as the Labour seat lead?
When the election's going to be, well, I think the panel were discussing autumn, maybe trying to avoid the US election as well. That seems sensible to me. I actually just got an email in my inbox today saying, like, come along to Conservative conference in early October. That's kind of interesting because that's one of the complicating factors here. If they go early in October, they're potentially going to have to cancel their conference. That means a lot of lost income, potentially a lot of annoyed partners that get involved with conferences because they're being told it's happening right now. So maybe that pushes it a bit later, despite the US complications. The other thing is, Rishi Sunak doesn't seem to be very good at making firm decisions and not very good at making them stick with his party either. So you think, well, what would happen if he makes no decision at all? January. So that's still, I think, a potential option. That's the default option if he never makes a decision at all. And then in terms of the Labour seat lead, well, it really depends a little bit on these geography factors that we've just been talking about, how the smaller parties do, how the Labour vote is distributed, as well as how much of a lead they have. But if you were to take the central prediction, you're looking at a Labour majority of at least 100 at the moment on the central prediction from the polling. So how big do you think that seat lead will be? Do you believe the polls? Do you think they narrow a bit? I'd probably be a bit cautious and think, well, maybe there will be a little bit of that narrowing. Like I said, we may all regret that 6 months from now and say, oh, we knew all along it was going to be a big one. But so I would say maybe about a Labour sort of majority of about 80 to 100 seats. That's not a seat lead, though. So in terms of the seat lead, I have to do the mental arithmetic on that, but they'll be a long way ahead of the Conservatives.
And give us an impression of what it's like on election night for you as you're looking at this data streaming in, comparing it to what you thought was going to happen maybe 5-6 hours before.
Well, I mean, election day and night is really, I think, quite unusual for us on the exit poll team, because it's kind of like being in a kind of different time zone, because we've spent 6 hours kind of mentally digesting what we think the result is before anybody else has even thought about the result. So we feel like, especially in the first couple of hours, like everyone else is sort of playing mental catch up to us, because it's like they're all like trying to make sense of this, and you can see them going through the phases of thinking about it that we've already all done all day long. And then the night itself, once the results start to flow in, it's a very weird sort of two-paced rhythm. Early on, very slow. You get a couple of results from Sunderland because they're always racing with Newcastle to be first. You get them about midnight, enough until about 1:30. And then it's like bedlam from that point on. And you're just like flying by the seat of your pants on adrenaline, trying to make sense of it. Because what we're always looking for is things we can tell the BBC audience about what the result means. Things that we can pick up in the data that tell us a little bit about how the country has voted, why they voted this way, who's moved, who hasn't moved. So we're just constantly running all of our models and our stats and trying to spot things that we can then pass over to the broadcast team. And so you just constantly in that zone, so the hours just fly by, and then it's like it's dawn, you're tired, and most of the results are declared, and you're like, where did that time go?
And any plans to use any AI to analyse some of the volume of data that comes in to things that maybe you couldn't normally get around to?
No plans this time. I don't think we have anyone on the team that's like really a whiz kid on that. So you know, this is partly a sort of aging dinosaurs problem, but also the volume of data itself is not that huge. You know, you've got 600 seats, you've got bits of census data, you've got all this kind of thing. And much of what you're doing is trying to apply some human judgment to, like, what are the interesting stories here? What are the elements in all of this analysis that are interesting? I can imagine a situation where, you know, not necessarily AI, but automated techniques to pick out the strongest relationships would be useful. The exit poll actually does some of that already. It's not AI, it's just standard statistical modelling. But I could see a role for other tools that enabled us to sort of zero in on those things a bit quicker. That would be interesting, but you know, not a skill I have, so we're going to have to hire someone younger and smarter.
Not this year. Rob, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, that was fun. Thanks to all of our guests. And if you're new to the show, why not hit follow in your podcast app of choice? My name is Matt Deegan, and the producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.